I am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. Continuing to read from Campaign Number 3, The New York Campaign Phase 1, from August 26th to September 16th, 1776. The essay entitled All London Was Afloat. We pick up the story in the summer of 1776 as the British turn their attention to New York as the war with America began in 1775. With the arrival of the British Army off Sandy Hook, Staten Island, New York became indefensible and was ordered evacuated by Washington. The British Army took possession of its first foothold in New York, much to the delight of its royal governor, William Tyrone, who wrote to London on July 8th, "I have the satisfaction to acquaint your lordship that General Howe disembarked the troops under his command on Staten Island, New York, the 2nd, without opposition, on which occasion the inhabitants of the island came down to welcome the arrival of their deliverers and have since afforded the army every supply and accommodation in their power. On Saturday last, I reviewed the militia of the island at Richmond Town, which near 400 appeared, who cheerfully, on my recommendation, took the oath of allegiance to Britain and fidelity to His Majesty. British expectations of encountering sympathetic Americans met with some initial success as loyalists from both New Jersey and Long Island clandestinely made their way to Staten Island to join them. On July 23rd, Ambrose Searle, secretary to Admiral Lord Richard Howe of Great Britain, met several people who had just escaped out of Long Island from the tyranny of those insolent demagogues who, under pretenses of superior liberty, are imposing upon all about them the worst of bondage. It excited one's sympathy to see their poor, meager faces and to hear their complaints of being hunted for their lives like game into the woods and swamps, only because they would not renounce their allegiance to their king and affection for their country. The British army arrayed against Washington included some American troops, raised the previous winter by Loyalists, primarily from Dutchess and Westchester counties along the Hudson. Massachusetts Loyalist Edward Winslow, Muster Master General of the American Provincial Forces, described their early plight, stating, "The first provincial recruits that joined the army was a party called the York Volunteers. They were collected about the North River before the troops appeared in that quarter and escaped to the King's ships at Sandy Hook. After some months, they were forwarded to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where they arrived a few days before the embarkation of the troops. There they were reviewed and formed into two companies. At that time, it was said that no provision was made or fund established from which these unfortunate men could be clothed or accoutred, and they embarked with the troops with only the wretched remnant of apparel in which they had escaped from the revels 6 or 8 months before. In this distress, they landed at Staten Island, New York. A few small articles were bestowed on them while there, but nothing to relieve them essentially." With every indication that New York City would be the intended target for the 1776 British campaign, Washington had months to make defensive preparations. By August 3rd, Washington's Continentals and state troops mustered some 20,537 officers and men, with thousands more on the march to join him. His army was then composed primarily of the numbered Continental regiments Congress had established at the beginning of the year, although they often went simply by their commander's name. Brigades typically consisted of 5 or more regiments, usually commanded by a brigadier general or colonel. While Washington would take comfort in numbers, there are any numbers of worries to vex him. Despite an assembly of troops that would never be equaled again in the course of the war in point of numbers, his army could not concentrate in one place. The New York City area encompasses long stretches of coastline, including Manhattan and Staten and Long Island, not to mention New Jersey, Connecticut, and the Hudson River Valley. All would need protection from the Royal Navy and General Howe's troops. A brigade of soldiers would be required to defend the Hudson Highlands, particularly Forts Montgomery and Constitution. A brigade each would have to build and occupy Fort Lee in New Jersey and its sister Fort Washington on the opposite side of the Hudson River. Further, troops would be needed further south of Fort Lee at Paulus Hook, modern-day Jersey City, and Bergen Point, modern-day Bayonne, New Jersey. Brigadier General Hugh Mercer, meanwhile, took charge of thousands of men serving in Pennsylvania's flying camp, garrisoning such places as New Brunswick, Perth Amboy, Elizabethtown, New Jersey. Flying camp troops were raised in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Maryland for the purpose of providing a mobile force that could move from place to place on the defensive, covering such areas where the British might land. They served primarily, but not exclusively, in New Jersey, particularly as the campaign progressed. Scattered among Washington's troops were companies and regiments of rifle-bearing troops. While the majority of long arms used in the war by both sides were smoothbore muskets, each made use of rifles. A rifle differed from a musket in that its barrel was grooved, making the projectile spin when fired, increasing both its range and accuracy. Rifles were not universally adopted heretofore because of the increased time they took to load and their general unsuitability for holding a bayonet fixed onto the barrel. The reputation that riflemen enjoyed as marksmen became almost mythical, prompting the British to adopt loose files, 18-inch intervals, between the soldiers, and often to discard lace and other signs of distinction that could attract undue attention. One Irish officer serving in the British Army noted the unique rifle dress, which is a frock and trousers of linen fringed with knotting, which in warm weather is worn singly. In cold, covers their body clothes, and is very convenient for the woods. Some of these riflemen were initially posted to New Jersey, where they were among the first to make contact with the British. Some took the opportunity to desert, as noted by New Jersey loyalist Stephen Kemble, a British Army officer on July 15th, stating, "Two riflemen came in with two inhabitants from Huawei. The riflemen desert every day." Other riflemen may have left their reputation get the better of their judgment, as indicated in this anecdote written by a soldier in Elizabethtown, New Jersey on July 25th, stating, "Yesterday a rifleman crossed the river and when within 15 yards of the enemy's outposts, desired them to surrender. At that instant, he received a ball through his head, which killed him on the spot." While preparations for war commenced in New York's vicinity, there were also talks of peace. On July 12th, His Majesty's ship Eagle arrived carrying Admiral Lord Richard Howe, brother to British General William Howe. The Howe brothers were empowered by the Crown to act as commissioners for restoring peace in America. They had not expected the nature of the conflict to change fundamentally before they had any chance to carry out this assignment. But unbeknownst to them, Congress had, in one historic declaration, changed its objective from seeking redress of grievances with the British Crown to establishing a new independent country. Informed of this historic event on July 9, 1776, George Washington wrote to John Hancock, stating, "I perceive that Congress may have employed in deliberating on measures of the most interesting nature. It is certain that it is not with us to determine in many instances what consequences will flow from our counsels. But yet it behoves us to adopt such as under the smiles of a gracious and all-kind providence will be most likely to promote our happiness. I trust the late decisive part that they have taken is calculated for that end and will secure us that freedom and those privileges which have been and are refused us, contrary to the voice and nature of the British Constitution. Agreeable to the request of Congress, I cause the Declaration of Independence to be proclaimed before all the army under my immediate command, and have the pleasure to inform them that the measure seemed to have their most hearty assent. the expressions and behavior both of officers and men testifying their warmest approbation of it. A jubilant crowd of soldiers, Sons of Liberty, and residents showed their approbation in a more tangible way by marching to Bowling Green and pulling down the statue of King George III, which had stood 6 years. The physical embodiment of the monarch was trundled off to Connecticut to serve the needs of the forces of the United States of America by being melted into musket balls. While the British still could conceivably land anywhere, Long Island seemed the most logical place to do so. This was confirmed by British deserters and escaped American prisoners, no doubt transmitting camp gossip rather than factual knowledge of future maneuvers. Some reported the intended movement of the British troops to be sometime between August 23rd and 25th, 1776, covered by gunboats with the British fleet. This estimate was not far off the mark, for early on the morning of August 22nd, scores of flatboats, bateaux, and galleys filled with British, Hessian, and Loyalist troops clad in red, blue, and green landed in several debarkations near Galveston, now wholly within Brooklyn, New York. At the time of the Revolution, Kings County encompassed the villages of Brooklyn, New Utrecht, Flatlands, Grafson, Bushwick, and Flatbush. The gunboats proved unnecessary as the 15,000 or so troops were unopposed by the Americans. One witness noted, "The soldiers and sailors seemed as merry as in a holiday and regaled themselves with the fine apples which hung everywhere upon the trees in great abundance." George Washington had not been inactive. With New Jersey seemingly less of a target, in mid-August, the Continental Commander started drawing off troops from Amboy and other places opposite Staten Island, some of which would have a prominent role in the upcoming fighting with the British, namely the two Pennsylvania Rifle Battalions and Colonel Attlee's Musketry Regiment. Hugh Mercer, commanding New Jersey, would see his command siphoned off throughout the campaign as the situation in New York evolved. The British landing at Gravesend led to rumors and some action between the warring parties. One New England soldier, picking up gossip he had heard in Manhattan, wrote to his brother in Massachusetts that the British were in a hollow and our men on the hills all around them, which was true enough. He continued, however, "Last week, four men were poisoned to death down in the city with chocolate by the Tories. It is said that there was six more killed in the same manner." There had also been actual plots of the city against George Washington. The uncovering of a treacherous correspondence involving a senior officer, Lieutenant Colonel Herman Zedwitz of the 1st New York Regiment, led to a court-martial which lent credence to the rumor-mongering. There were, however, no known factual reports of death by chocolate. There was death by musket and rifle ball, however. Each side used its light troops to skirmish with the other. Such actions buoyed up spirits, with the New York Gazette newspaper reporting on August 26, "An advance party of the regulars are encamped a little to the northwest of Flatbush Church and have a battery somewhat to the westward of Mr. Jeremiah Vanderbilt's, from which they continue to fire briskly on our people, who often approach and discharge their rifles within 200 yards of their works. We've had only four men wounded since the enemy landed, but we were certain many of them fell. One, a Hessian, was killed last Friday. Several dollars were found in his pocket, and he had an excellent rifle." On the opposing side, General Howe noted in his general orders for August 25th that he highly approved of the spirited behavior of Captains Campbell and Grant and the detachment of New York companies upon the scouting parties of yesterday. The time for skirmishing soon came to an end. The main event was at hand. The British plan for the early morning hours of August 27th involved feints, deception, and perhaps some luck. On their far left, the American right, anchored on Gowanus Bay to the north and advancing from the Narrows past Yellow Hook, with the 4th and 6th British brigades along with the 42nd Highlanders, New York Companies, and 10 pieces of cannon, all under the command of Major General James Grant. This was a feint. In the center, Lieutenant George Leopold von Heister commanded the Hessian brigades that would attack at Flatbush, among the heights of Guam, with Cornwallis and additional British troops in reserve. The main British force, in two divisions, led by Clinton and Hugh Earl Percy, would take 10,000 men on a wide sweep beyond the right of the British line towards Bedford, slip through the unguarded Jamaica Pass, and bring the bulk of the army behind the American left flank. The first indication of the British came on the American right, where 120 men of Attlee's Pennsylvanians formed a guard at the Red Lion Inn, a tavern along the coast of Gowanus Bay. There, at 1 a.m, General James Grant's troops smashed into the guard, who retreated back after a few shots, leaving a lieutenant and 15 men behind as prisoners. While many of Washington's troops remained in the extensive fortifications opposite Manhattan, thousands more now moved forward to block any British advance. The American line formed with Sullivan facing von Heister in the center and Lord Stirling in front of General Grant's American force. The rifle troops under Colonel Miles and Lieutenant Colonel Broadhead that had been left unmoved to enforce Stirling's division, which now included Smallwood's Maryland Regiment under Major Mordecai Gist, the Delaware Regiment under Colonel John Haslett, and the Pennsylvanians under Attlee. The removal of the riflemen to the right of the line would prove to be unfortunate. Soon after daybreak, von Heister and his corps commenced a cannonade upon Sullivan's troops, followed up by the advance of his blue-coated Hessian brigades. With both Stirling and Sullivan fully engaged, the British under Clinton then appeared before them. Confronted only by a patrol of officers, which the British captured, Clinton and Percy's troops poured through the pass between Sullivan and Stirling's American forces and their fortifications. The American rout soon commenced. The fighting had so far raged between Stirling's troops and those of General Grant on the left of the British line. The British suffered some of their heaviest losses of the day when their light troops fought against many of the Pennsylvanian Rife troops. One British captain wrote home to his mother, "I was lucky in my escape, for I had my right-hand man wounded and my left-hand man killed. I had 3 killed and 6 wounded in my company in about 3 minutes before falling in with about 400 riflemen unawares. They are not so dreadful as I expected, or they must have destroyed me and my whole company before we were supported by anybody else." The casualties among Americans was just as heavy. Our Lieutenant Colonel Caleb Perry was shot through the head, wrote an officer of Attlee's regiment. With Clinton's British force closing the noose around the two American divisions, the race was on to retreat back to the safety of the fortifications. For some, the choice was to surrender or attempt escape via Gowanus Creek. Isaac Peer, a soldier in Van Cortlandt's battalion of Head's brigade, had to retreat to make his escape and ford a creek water up to his neck. The retreat was covered by the Maryland troops. "We had not retreated near a quarter of a mile," wrote one Marylander, "before we were fired upon by an advance part of the enemy, and those upon our rear were playing upon us with their artillery. Our men fought with more than Roman virtue, and I am convinced would have stood until they were shot down to a man. We forced the advance party, which first attacked us, to give way, through which opening we got a passage down to the side of a marsh, seldom before waded over, which we passed, and then swam a narrow river, all the time exposed to the fire of the enemy. The right wing of the battalion, unable to cross the water, was shot down or surrendered. The Maryland Regiment, with about 400 men, lost 259 officers and men killed, wounded, or taken. With the retreat into the fortifications by the defeated American troops, the battle was done. At a cost of just 41 British dead and some 257 wounded, along with less than 30 Hessian casualties, British General Howe had achieved an overwhelming victory over some of George Washington's best troops. For the nascent army of the fledgling United States, The battle was a rough coming-of-age experience, pushing men without much training or experience to the limits of their endurance. Rifleman James Carr of Pennsylvania underwent the most severe and arduous duty, having in the course of the day, between the post where they were stationed in the morning and the Flatbush Road, encountered and fought five or six different detachments of the enemy. There was no shortage of blame going around among both officers and men. Less generalship never was shown in the Army since the art of war was understood, complained American Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Broadhead of the Riflemen. The Pennsylvania battalions had been thrown into chaos, marching and countermarching as new information appeared. When they tried to stand, the troops to their front from New England and New Jersey threw them into disorder by retreating through their lines. The New Jersey troops, some 1,600 or so, were a five-battalion state corps under Brigadier General Nathaniel Head, raised less than 2 months before the battle. These troops had been part of Sullivan's force. Matthias Riker, a 20-year-old Bergen County soldier in Colonel Philip Van Cortlandt's battalion, survived his ordeal, but not unscathed, writing, "They had to retreat with great loss. The order was every man should make the best of his way. He retreated through the woods and saw the Pennsylvania troops taken on his retreat. He was wounded in the knee by a ball." The other battalions of the brigade were bloodied as well, including the one commanded by Colonel Philip Johnston, who received a ball in his breast, which put an end to the life of as brave an officer as ever commanded a battalion. Another battalion commander in the brigade, Colonel Ephraim Martin, received a similar wound, but survived to fight another day. British General Howe's loyalist troops fought well. However, their lack of uniforms would prove fatal, a reminder that friendly fire is never actually friendly. Their exploits were witnessed by Army Surgeon Thompson Forrester, who wrote, "The New Yorkers merited the confidence General Howe reposed in them by their very gallant behavior on this occasion. The only mark of distinction the New Yorkers had to be known from the enemy in the field was a red cross that they wore on their hats, or rather caps. This distinction was scarcely sufficient, as an accident in this engagement disagreeably proved. The light infantry and New Yorkers were ordered to dash into the thickest of the woods, by which means they surprised the enemy in the rear, drew them out absolutely with the bayonet with great slaughter. The New Yorkers were so hot in the pursuit that they followed them out of the wood onto the plain, where they were unfortunately mistaken by our battalion of light infantry for the enemy and received one fire before they were known." A testament to their service was provided by then-Sergeant Richard Vanderburg of Dutchess County, who received seven severe and dangerous wounds and was rendered for a considerable time incapable of serving. The Hessian troops under General von Heister also acquitted themselves satisfactorily in the battle, losing just two killed and 26 officers and men wounded. The Hessians distinguished themselves against the best of their troops and riflemen, one regimental commander boasted. "If the Americans are all as bad as they were on that day, this will be more of a hunt than a war. It will still be too bad for many an honest fellow who can be killed by these knaves." Several days after the battle, which frightened them so, they still shiver at the word Hessians. That fear would not last the rest of the war. While the battle was a terrible drubbing for George Washington's troops, the loss was not complete. Indeed, it could have been catastrophic for the Americans if the British had immediately pushed their success. But General Henry Clinton of the British believed the numerous works and trenches built by Washington's men opposite Manhattan were only occupied by 800 men, over an extent he considered as needing over seven times that amount to be adequately defended. "I had that moment," Clinton wrote afterwards, "but little inclinations to check the order of our troops when I saw the enemy flying in such a panic before them. I was also not without hope that His Excellency General William Howe, who was on a neighboring hill and of course saw their confusion, might be tempted to order us to march directly forward down the road to the ferry, by which, if we succeeded, everything on the island might have been ours." To be fair, neither Howe nor Clinton could have known with any certainty how many troops manned the fortifications, and Clinton's estimate was well below the thousands Washington actually had posted there. The most recent major battle Howe had fought in, on a fortified hill outside Boston in June 1775, had cost the British some 900 killed and wounded, losses that could not be easily replaced. One Hessian officer witnessing the rout noted, stating, "The enemy retreated in small groups and in great confusion towards the Brooklyn lines, where they have built fortifications strong enough to withstand an assault of 50,000 men. On both wings they have zigzag trenches, casemated and supplied with provisions for 350 men. In front of these fortifications is a picketed double trench. In this manner, they have raised one work behind another as far as the sea. On their right wing, moreover, is a woods with many trenches and strong abates. On the highest spot of a small peninsula called Red Hook, they have raised a battery to keep the New York Channel clear and prevent us from occupying the woods." General Howe freely admitted in his official report that American works could have been carried by his troops, whom he had to prevail upon to desist from the attempt. But as it was apparent the lines must have been ours at a very cheap rate by regular approaches, I would not risk the loss that might have been sustained in the assault. Reading from the 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, Campaign Number 3, the New York Campaign, Phase 1, August 26 to September 16, 1776, will be continued. This has been American History. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.